This is Hitchhiking Off the Map.
You never knew who was the enemy, so you had to assume that everybody was the enemy. I remember my father once telling me when I was quite young.
We met some of the Latinos in Carson City that the Native Americans were so scared of, and we realized they were scared of them too.
I was scared of the logistics of living, but oh God, I was alive.
My father once told me, never trust anyone, not even your own shadow, which it doesn't even border on paranoia. It goes beyond paranoia.
I said, Mother, these are our friends, these are our brothers.
And knowing, not being frightened at that.
And when you really can't feel that there's anything to trust, that makes you feel completely disconnected and alien. It almost makes you lose sanity.
Coming to you from that legendary state of California, and only a few miles from Bodega Bay, where it is believed that Sir Francis Drake, on his round-the-world voyage, made landing and had absolutely no idea where he was, which has become a kind of California tradition. Where was I?
Well, a few minutes ago you were in our studio in Sebastopol, California, but I'm not really sure where you are right now.
Well, that's just... This is Hitchhiking Off the Map, and I am Conrad Bishop.
And I am Elizabeth Fuller. And there is a theme to this show buried in here somewhere.
Well, maybe the theme today, I'm not sure exactly why we actually need to have a theme, except that public radio does that kind of thing. But when we were putting together the interview with Arturo, I kept thinking, wait a minute, what is the story here? What's the center of it? And then I realized, I am talking with this guy right at the point where he is asking himself the same question. Guess what? He's alive. Being alive means that, no, you're not stuffed and mounted with a little card saying, this is your story. You are in the middle of it. And as a friend would say, that is so very California.
Or that is so very human. This is Arturo Castillo.
This is maybe about cultural identity, or Los Angeles, or love. We talked in L.A. just after he'd moved to a new apartment, amid stuff being sorted and prints being hung. He's a photographer as well as an actor. And I'm not sure there's a linear story here, or even a clear sense of what's being searched for. I guess what we're sharing here is just 10 minutes or so in the resonant life of a friend. Arturo Castillo's parents were Mexican. His dad is a physician. He was born in St. Louis, moved to Mexico City, then back to the States, then Saigon, then Mexico, then Europe.
Spent about 15 years traveling and working throughout Europe. Eventually I ended up staying in England, in London. Was there for about 12 years. You know, I spent time again in Paris and spent some time in Munich and Madrid. And also in Florence. I just was bumming about, really. And then, as I said, I settled down in London and did my drama training there. And that's when I got serious about theater. I was exhausted. I had been working really hard in England. I was a partner in a very, very busy, popular restaurant. And I was also directing. I just felt like I needed a break. And that first year that I got back to the States, I bought a car and just drove around the whole country. And I spent that year going down roads that I didn't even know where they would end up taking me. I ended up meeting a gentleman who became a very, very dear friend. And we actually started a theater company together in Philadelphia. It was just exciting to be making theater in a very passionate way with colleagues who were as passionate about doing that as well.
And then he moved to L.A.
to work in film. I was more interested in working in film as an actor. I don't think anybody quite knew what to make of me when I first got out there. There was a certain momentum that initially did happen. I got very good agents, But again, I don't think any of them really quite knew what to do with me. I've never been more aware of limitations simply because I am of Mexican descent than I have been in LA. Nowhere else have I felt that. It is by far and away the most racist city I've ever known. I'll give you a really perfect example. I work a great deal doing voiceover. I would say 90% of that work is for the Hispanic market. There's absolutely no reason why I shouldn't book work in English-speaking spots. I did my drama training in London. I'm very capable of handling the English language with great style and panache, if you will. To them, I'm a Latino actor, and therefore, that's the market that I will be used in. And as I said, that's a very, very banal example, I suppose, of what the kind of thing I'm referring to. But it is a closing off of options for a specific type of person based simply on race, which I had never experienced anywhere else.
I asked him, do you classify yourself Latino, Anglo, culturally diverse?
I remember when we moved to Mexico, neither my sister nor myself, we spoke no Spanish. We only spoke English. When we left Mexico, my sister and I had forgotten every word of English that we had ever known. We had to relearn the English language. We never went back to live in Mexico for any long period of time. So when I open my mouth, like whenever I am in Mexico, I give myself away as being a foreigner. I'm not someone who is truly Mexican. On the other hand, when I'm here in the United States, I am made acutely aware that I'm not really considered American. When I was living in London, I was treated like a foreigner, but I was a foreigner. And it felt like I was living a reality. And so it was literally as if I was living in my own skin when I lived there. What's interesting to me is that I didn't really start to insist on speaking Spanish with my parents until I was living in London as an adult. And I became involved with a huge Latin-speaking community there. We're talking of a lot of Latinos who were exiles from their country, from Chile, from Argentina. And there was quite a large Mexican community as well, but mostly it was from Central America and South America. And I just felt ashamed that I was not able to hold my own in what was purportedly my native language. And I truly became much more Mexican when I was living in London and very proud of my heritage. And my parents actually were quite astounded when I came back from England and insisted only on speaking Spanish with them. And now to this day, that's all we speak. It's been a very interesting kind of journey to that, you know, traveling further and further towards who we are. I do believe that it's important to feel connected to something. And I would consider myself not to be... I think it was Paul Bowles who was being interviewed, and he was asked, what's the difference between a tourist and a traveler? And he said that the tourist is somebody who just goes and may spend a month or two in a place, but then they always go back to their home ground. And the traveler never really has a home ground. And I would probably consider myself more that I don't really have any place specifically that I consider home other than my cultural heritage. Because geographically, I've just gone from one place to the next, never really feeling like this is it. Certainly I don't feel like that in LA. You know, we are all fellow travelers who just have found a place that feels most comfortable as a sort of home base without it being home.
So I wondered, what is the search? We caught him again when he drove up to Northern California for a visit and said he was leaving LA.
I used to think that was that revolved entirely around my work. That's no longer the case. And I'm incredibly clear about that right now. I'm getting older, and the thing that is most important to me right now is companionship. Truth be told, I could probably contemplate living anywhere if I knew that the reason why I was there was because I was going to be with the person I wanted to be with, and you know, that I was going to create a life. Not live a lifestyle, but create a life. Having someone who can be my partner in life. That's also probably another thing that I'm going to be very grateful about for leaving LA, is because I had two very devastating relationships with women there that have affected me more than anything else in my life. LA right now is kind of toxic for me. So I came up here, and Elizabeth mentioned this woods that I should go to see, Muir Woods. But what was really interesting was coming back from the woods. As I mentioned to you, when I first got back to this country, I drove around the country. And among the things that I did was I went to a friend's wedding that was in Vancouver. And so I took the coast all the way down. And as I was getting close to San Francisco, I made a stop at this town called Stinson Beach. And I remember staying there for a week. When I left England, I had been involved with a woman who I was very, very fond of. But we both knew that it just wasn't going to happen. But I was in a melancholy state because I had just seen her at the wedding. And so when I was coming back from the woods, I ended up in Stinson Beach. It was very, very foggy. And I had this tape on in the car. What was incredible was that the music that was on the other side was music that I had been listening to while I had been driving down the coast when I first got back to this country. So there was this incredible sort of circularity, this coming around in the merry-go-round, so to speak, to the same point. Because as I was driving in through this fog that felt like I was, you know, coming into Brigadoon, I walked out there. And Stinson Beach, it's like this plain field of sand. That just, there's nothing there. It's just flat. And then there's this ocean in front of you. It was dusk, and it's foggy and drizzling. And the only thing that was in the landscape were these two people, a man and a woman, who were walking toward each other from opposite ends of the beach. And they finally came together and they started talking. And then they hugged. And then they kept going in opposite directions. It was one of the most extraordinary things. It was like an epiphany somehow for me to see that. And I can't help but feel that somehow I was meant to be there at that moment to witness that event and to make of that what I will.
In Los Angeles, we were talking with Arturo Castillo. Stories. Well, what is a story? We have some friends in the Southeast, and they've evolved a process of creating new theater pieces from what they call story circles. People come together around a general theme, maybe, and then they tell their stories. And out of this comes a very rich stew or casserole or salad,
whatever you will. Yeah, the danger, I think, is that, you know, taking people's stories and honoring them and faithfully conveying them is a wonderful thing. Yeah. But if it's a living story, my instinct is that it needs to be probed and questioned and teased and challenged as seriously as, you know, that disagreement about, what were you actually doing at that party?
Well, oh, I didn't think you saw.
I didn't mean anything.
No.
And so on. But I think we tend to save our challenges for things we're angry at, you know, politicians we despise, that sort of thing. And I think our most vigorous interrogations should be directed with great love and tact toward the things we love the most. Because that's the way they grow.
Well, as you can tell, we're in kind of an amorphous mood today, so we thought we'd just put together some fragments from conversations we've had with people who were really vivid, but those things wouldn't fit in the time span of whatever we were editing. Stories that didn't really have a clear point or a beginning, middle, or an end.
Yeah,
or...
I think the most destructive phrase in the history of civilization, other than bombs away, is the moral of the story is. I mean, what more perfect way to shrink wrap and freeze dry a fragment of human experience and just drain every bit of nourishment out of it. So yes, some of these fragments make good stories, and some are really just fragments. And I'd like to invite you, despite anything I said about interrogating and so on, forget all that nonsense, and just listen to these things as things that somebody just happened to wind up saying. And for once, 8 minutes of public radio that's not full of experts or activists or opinion makers or writers selling their work, not to disparage any of those people, but just people who are not making a point, who've kind of managed to live and actually be pretty decent people.
Here are some friends. And here are the stories that your friends might tell if you give them the chance.
I had been single for, like I said, about 10 years at that time. And I fell in love in the year that I was preparing to leave. And people all over the place were going, well, you're going to take him with you, aren't you? And I'm going, no. This is my trip. He's got his own stuff to do. And yeah, I left this really wonderful, hot relationship, knowing that it might not be there when I came back, but also knowing that this was the most time, this was the next step. There was no other next step.
There was one incident when I first got off the plane and my friend picked me up. There's throngs of people waiting outside of the airport. Mostly taxi cab drivers, but also people waiting for family and picking up tourists and whatever. And I didn't hear it because I don't speak Hindi. But my friend said the people were saying, Kalikata, 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 which means like black nigger, black thing. But I didn't know what they were saying anyway, so it didn't matter.
Just a huge spiritual awakening. My life changed radically. I had no idea that I even had an ego before that experience, and I had no idea that I was afraid. You know, I believe we are all of us deeply afraid, and most of us are not even in touch with that fear, and I had not been, and all of a sudden I was, the mask over that was pulled away, and I could see my control and my fear, and it was not a fun experience, but it was a useful experience.
We always seemed to have a link that was something more than just, it seemed to be a psychic link in a way. I remember one time I was driving back from Pittsburgh, and I remember this quite well. I remember as if it was yesterday. I was ready to pass this semi, this big truck, and it wasn't a limited access dual highway. It was two lanes in each direction with an island in the middle. And I was ready to pass this semi, and something in the back of my mind said, you better apply the brakes. So I just went out and hit the brakes, and there was a car that had come in to beat the semi across the road. The semi just missed him, and if I had been passing, I would have hit him broadside. So anyhow, I just said, okay, well, thank you. And when I got back to college, I called her and told her I was back, and she was in tears. And she said, I felt that you were in grave danger, and we worked out the time, and the time that she felt this was exactly the time that I had had that near miss.
Blatant thing that comes to mind, but I have incidences like this like almost weekly or more. But several days after the 9/11 occurred, in fact 2 days after, there was helicopters that were flying back and forth over my house, and it turned out that there was some man who had a loaded gun who was running through the complexes. And the man was dressed all in black and had a red satchel. Then a man drove up who had seen the helicopter from a road maybe a mile away. He tracked it. He was an older man, 78 years old. And we started getting on this conversation on how people give up their power when there's a lot of chaos. And he goes, "Oh, do you know who I am?" And I went, "No, why would I?" And he said, "I'm a retired U.S. intelligence officer. I used to work right over here at the Santa Rosa Airport." And he proceeded to tell me the history of the United States in 1776 when the Illuminati coalesced to take over the world powers, and proceeded to tell me of all these projects that our government was involved in. And I kept shaking my head like, "Yes, I know this." And he says, "Did you used to work for the CIA too?"
On a Tuesday, I'm walking in Riverside Drive Park, and it's late at night, and it's like 11 o'clock, and it's a shortcut for my way home. And I see this guy sort of come out of these bushes and start running. He gets to me, and he stops running, and he walks by me. And as soon as he gets by me again, he starts running again. And I thought, well, that's really curious. He didn't stop running because he was tired. He stopped running because he saw me. I mean, I sort of registered in my head. So I kept on walking, and I got to where these bushes were. He ran out, and there was this 22-year-old kid who had been stabbed to death. And so I looked down. I knew from my Perry Mason movies not to pick up the knife and say, "Oh, what's this?" You know. So I called the police, and I ended up looking at mugshots that whole night. So that was Tuesday. Thursday, I'm coming out of the subway stop on 96th and Broadway, and a 14-year-old had just been stabbed. And all his school books were on the steps, and the pencil box, and everything was like strewn on the subway stops. And they had forgotten to pick up his school books, and I sort of picked up his school books and sort of offered them to somebody, but no one seemed to want them. So that was Thursday. Friday, I'm coming home on Riverside Drive, coming down this hill to Riverside, where I live on Riverside Drive, and I hear this furious steps behind me. Now, I had just borrowed my best friend's best sport coat because I had this callback audition for a big show in New York, and I was going to wear it to this audition because I didn't have anything really nice, and I wanted to look really good. So this guy, I turn around, this guy's furious steps, and this guy's holding a knife, and he's saying, "Hand it over." And all I could think of was to say, "You know, it's not mine. If it was mine, you could have it. But it's not mine. I borrowed it." And for some reason, the woman across the street screamed. And it distracted him. And then I started screaming. I don't know why I thought that what that was going to accomplish. But I started screaming. The woman across the street is screaming. This guy takes off and runs away. But it was very funny because I went to a cocktail party about 3 months later, before I left. It was like a farewell cocktail party, and this woman was talking about how, you know, people should report things that happened to them. And I said, "Well, you know, I didn't report my mugging, attempted mugging, because, you know, who's going to find this guy? You know, he ran up the street." And she said, "Well, I saw a mugging, and I, you know, got the police, but because the person who it happened to didn't report it, it went unsolved. They couldn't hold the guy." As it turns out, she had seen my mugging. Small world. So it was time to get out.
My mom, the way she met my stepfather, is that they both worked at Hollywood Accessories at this factory, and he had papers, although they were trickle, they were fixed, and she didn't. Anyway, my stepfather, who I didn't know yet, at the time that this happened, I was 2 years old. I don't remember this story my mom told me, but he drove a forklift at the factory and my mom worked on the assembly line. Well, the INS came in, immigration came in, and they went through the process of going row by row, starting to check papers. And so people are screaming, some people are running, and the INS is actually not chasing anyone, but going person by person checking papers. And if they didn't have any, they would cuff them and put them in a paddy wagon. So my stepdad has had an eye on my mom for quite a while, and he had been asking her out, and my mom didn't want to give him the time of day. Make a long story short, my stepfather decides to get my mother Martha. He pulls her to the side. He's all, "Come here. I'm going to put you in this box, and I'm going to raise you on the forklift." And so my mom's like, "What are you doing? Are you crazy?" So he picks her up. He picks my mother up, puts her on the box of this forklift, raises her up. Sure enough, a few minutes later, INS come. They look for my stepfather's papers, and sure, he has them. He has a social security. He shows his ID, and "Thank you very much, sir, and what's your name," and "Jesus," and so on, and they leave. And then an hour later, my mom is shaking, but she's out of that box. And this was one of those times she wasn't deported. And amidst all of the chaos that's going on and all the stories we hear that are so horrible about immigration, it was a love story between my mom and my stepdad of how they met and how now she would have a cup of coffee with him.
The voices you heard were Damira, Sam Reynolds, Christina Sukal, Bill Middleton, Judy Dragon, Fred Ponsloff, and Cesar Cruz.
This is Hitchhiking Off the Map, produced by The Independent Eye, with funding from the National Endowment for the Arts and the contributing members of the Hitchhikers Guild. You can become a member or send us a story if you visit our website, where you can also listen to past shows. All of that at www.independenteye.org.
And we'd like to remind you that if you hear something you'd like to share with friends, CDs are available of any show, or anthologies of our favorite pieces as holiday gifts for your strangest friends.
Next week, a man who travels to the poorest countries on earth to give away his friend's money.
And a suburban couple responds to a ghastly crime in exactly the way you'd expect.
This is Elizabeth Fuller.
And Conrad Bishop. Peace and joy.
Music. The music. I mean, there's certain pieces of music, I just feel them in ways that are totally raw emotionally. The food, you know, the spicing and the preparation and the idea of in Mexican households, it's very common. The kitchen is always busy. There's always something happening in the kitchen and people are always welcome. And, you know, food and music and conversation play a very important part. So, yeah, I mean, those are the things that really do connect me in a very visceral way.